we don't recruit angels. We recruit devils and make them better. We live by a good set of values and standards, but that takes time to embed into people. And humans are humans, so they're never going to be perfect. We should never stop trying to improve ourselves. Everyone has their own life as well as their military life. We need to always remember where we come from. Everyone's a cog in the team, and if one isn't working properly or one isn't even there, then we're never going to function as well as we can.
For the last 4 years, Paul Carney has been the Army's senior soldier. As the Army's Command Sergeant Major, he's had a pivotal role connecting the strategic to the tactical and being the voice of the unheard soldier. It feels like this job was made for him. He's thoroughly thoughtful, cares deeply about the people he's represented, and takes his responsibility to speak truth to power seriously. Today, we discuss the importance of curiosity, learning from each other, shining a light on our blind spots, and how honesty about our challenges makes us human. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Paul.
I come from a Navy town, and my grandparents were Navy, and they used to take me to the Royal Tournament in London. I saw the Royal Marines, I saw the Army, and that was what I wanted to be. From 8 years old, I knew that that was going to be the profession. And when we look back, I thought that maybe I'd eased off of that, although it was still my sort of aim. And then I found my old school end of year book, and I read through the comments, and every single one of them had, "Good luck, we're going for the Army. We hope you get into the Army." So maybe I was talking about it a little more than I thought I was. And actually going through the process of joining was a little bit weird in itself. I'd got small ear canals, so I had to go back to the recruitment centre quite a few times. I didn't get the GCSEs that I'd hoped for. I always wanted to be a Royal Engineer. I wanted to be an electrician, and you had to have certain grades for that. But I didn't meet those grades, and so it looked like I was going to become a recce mech in the REME. But my scores from the maths, science, and English tests we'd done demonstrated more the sort of grades that I was used to getting, and they allowed me to join as a young apprentice.
Gosh, the smallest things could have changed everything, isn't it? Interesting. Did you know what your plan was for being in the Army? Did you join for 3 years or forever?
It used to be a big joke. Where my first unit was in Germany. We were working out of 432, so armoured personnel vehicles. You'd usually have about six or seven of you living in the back of one of those, and the ongoing joke, like it was a bad thing, was that you were known as being a lifer. And from day one, I was always going to be a lifer. And I think like many soldiers, they will talk about wanting to stay in the Army for as long as they enjoy it. And then you get to see people that serve as long as I have, if not longer, because we enjoy what we do.
And you're now the senior soldier in the Army. The Army Sergeant Major, often described as a big badge or the big badge. But can you explain what the Command Sergeant Major function is? Because it's a relatively new thing.
The British Army designed the NCO Corps in amongst the regimental system. But after battalion or regimental level, it was believed that officers knew what they were doing from then on in staff jobs and in more senior positions. The Americans created Command Sergeant Majors after the Vietnam War when they realized they needed discipline. They needed that senior voice of the soldier in the higher echelons. And about 10 years ago now, the British Army decided to follow a similar model. We already had Corps Sergeant Majors that were senior soldiers that would represent their cap badge, but we didn't have Command Sergeant Majors that supported the higher commanders. And it meant that our divisional commanders and our three star and then CGS all got given a senior soldier's voice. I guess our biggest role is truth to power, to ensure that we can get the tactical voice. And many people will say we are the champions of the soldiers, which I'd agree we are. But I think we're the tactical voice into the operational and strategic headquarters. And I think that's what's really important, because there's a whole layers of hierarchy to get through. And sometimes those good ideas will be filtered through, or those messages will be corrupted. And then we act as a voice from those headquarters back down into the tactical level. I often say that I feel like I'm the punch bag for Army headquarters. They come up with the good ideas, the new policies, but most of the time we'll stay in the Army headquarters to get onto the next job. And I'm going around the Army and basically explaining those policies or taking the feedback on what they are. What sounds good in an office might not necessarily always be good on the ground.
Sarah Catterall, who's the Command Sergeant Major of Strategic Command, describes the role of Command Sergeant Major as courier, thermometer, and translator. Is that something you would recognise?
Yeah, actually, when the paperwork was designed for the Command Sergeant Major, so it was originally Army terms, so the courier, passage of information, thermometer, to be basically a one-person climate assessment on a unit, to be able to go in and feel it and understand if it's working. And then the translator plays to that strategic language down to the tactical level, and then the tactical language into the strategic space. It's great, firstly, that that's how we identified ourselves in the Army, but the senior warrant officers across the services, so myself, the Navy, the RAF, and then Sarah and Stratcom, starting to talk and use the same language.
And that presumably is part of the power of the network, that you are connected across all parts of the armed forces to understand the service personnel's experience, and then you can act as the conduit to inform senior decision makers.
I think that's right. And I think the networking is exactly what we do. I spoke to my wife about my role and I said, oh, well, we're like fixers. She turned around to me and said, no, you're not fixers. Kind of gave that look back, which said, no, I know what my job is. And she said, no, you're a connector. You connect the problem to a solution, but you haven't got time to fix it yourself. And I think that's what's really powerful. In the same way that maybe a spy would, we have to build our networks out and create webs of networks and hopefully connect those issues to each other.
One of the concerns that some people might have is that you're effectively operating outside of what people would say is the chain of command, in that you're having that access into units, but not through the normal formation system. But presumably having that ability to break into units gives you that ability to know exactly what's going on there in a way that perhaps even the commanding officer doesn't know. So I'm guessing you're encouraging people to reach out and give you their truth.
Yeah, exactly. It can be hard. I work for CGS, the other command sergeant majors work for the GOCs, for Commander Field Army as examples. But we're there to be a force for good. We will always take an issue, a concern, and we like good news as well, but we'll take that to the right level that it needs to go to. So if we, for example, go into a unit and we pick up something that's not right, then we will speak to the CO, to the regimental sergeant major about that and say, hey, we've picked up on this. We think you've got the levers to do it. Can you please have a look at it? But if it needs to go higher, we will then also speak to the CO. So I regularly say to the regimental sergeant majors, to the CO's courses, I see them as vital cogs in the Army machine, whereas command sergeant majors are oil. You can do without us. You can't do without the cogs. We've only been around for 10 years. The Army was able to operate for 350 years without us. But I think we add the oil to just make the machine move a little bit easier and quicker.
Brilliant analogy. Brilliant. And one of the things that I observe from what people say about you is that you're very thoughtful as a person. And I wondered if that's something you've always had or whether that's something you've grown into.
It's nice that people say that. And I think it's a bit of both. I grew up in a tough upbringing, which I don't think is strange for soldiers of my era. I was bullied at certain points when I first joined the Army, and I just wouldn't take it. I grew up with sisters, and I just realised that actually by talking to people, understanding people, it made you better and it made the team better. And we're all in this same game together and we should be looking out for each other. Meeting my wife was probably one of the biggest turnarounds for me. I'm a 6'4" white soldier. I fit the mold. When I worked alongside my wife, I truly started to understand what it was like to be a woman of, her era in the army, and I'd watch her work twice as hard to achieve the same thing that I did. And that just really helped to open me up. And I think I wouldn't be in this job now if I hadn't met her and helped me to understand that bigger, broader picture and that more lived experience that everyone kind of has.
It's fascinating that we have these blind spots that we don't even know that are blind spots. And I have many. But one of the first ones I had was when I went to university and I studied feminism at university. I was the only bloke on the course. In the tutorial session, the women talked about their lived experiences, and it was a totally different world, the awfulness of the experiences they were enduring. And I would never have known it if I hadn't chosen to do that course. And so it's interesting that our experiences have been found out of love and of curiosity for studying. But how do we create the conditions where others feel that they will look for their blind spots in places they don't know?
I think there's a whole host of areas where we can do this. We had this great product when I was the Field Army Sergeant Major called the Walk-in Wardrobe, where we would get a host of minority groups in. They'd get on stage, talk about their lived experiences while they'd been in the army. And the crowd had free license to ask any question. And we'd created the environment, no names. People could then ask questions that might have been niggling at them, things that they weren't sure of. We've now extended that out across the whole army under what I would class as op teamwork. Mm-hmm. Each year, the whole army will stop for one day of inflection, of one day of looking at itself. The Army headquarters produces products and some recommendations, but we want each unit to kind of understand where their issues, where their concerns are, and where their blind spots are. Mm. A medical unit will have different blind spots to an infantry unit. And by opening up a day where it's basically a free-for-all, now's your time to ask the questions and you won't be judged. Be curious. Is there something you're not sure about? Now's the time to ask that question. And I think that's the big thing, is curiosity. Keep asking those questions. That's how I learned and how I developed.
Yes, and having those safe spaces for those important conversations is vital if people are to understand and learn, I suppose. One of the things I've heard you speak about very strongly is the importance of mentoring. And presumably also by mentoring someone who's not like you, you have a mutual beneficial experience from that. I think officers are overeducated broadly.
We'd agree on that.
But that paradoxically, there seems to be more education for officers, but less for soldiers. And I know that there's been big work recently about that. How did that come about?
I think we recognise that we all learn from each other. And I think when we look back to our regimental system, that was very much how soldiers developed. Sergeant majors would learn from their RSMs, colour sergeants would learn from the sergeant majors, and so on and so forth. The problem is when you have that sort of closed system, you miss those blind spots. By opening up across CAP badges, and certainly at the moment with the NCO Academy, is this opportunity to get soldiers of different CAP badges together. I often joke that the strength of the officer isn't the education, but the network that they have in their phone from the WhatsApp of all the groups that they've been in. I want exactly the same in the NCO world. Yeah. I want the infantry to understand what a medic goes through, what an engineer's course is, what an engineer does, and how we need each other to move forward.
I think you're the only soldier who's actually done the intermediate staff and command course. Is that right?
That is, yeah. So I was the first. My predecessor went on to do the course before he went out to the American Sergeant Major's Academy, and my replacement and the replacement SEAC is currently on the course as well.
The Senior Enlisted Advisors, the Chiefs.
That's correct, yeah. So my position in defence. So I was the first, and it was an absolute privilege. What was interesting was when I returned from the course, how interested senior officers were on what I thought of the course, and then what I thought of our young SO2s that were going through it, our majors.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier was the regimental system and the importance of that. And part of it is about generating an esprit de corps and a fighting spirit. But it's done through competition. I remember speaking to one of our guests who I said, when I joined the Black Watch, I thought it was the best unit in the whole of the army. And he said, when I joined my regiment, I knew mine was the best. And so there's a positive competition that comes from the regimental system. Do you think that that's a healthy approach to generate high-performing teams?
I do, as long as we all know that we're on the same side. In the same way that you want to be the best platoon, you want to be the best company, you want to be the best battalion, as long as you know that in the face of the enemy, that we're all on one team and that we all need each other. And that comes back to that education piece and breaking out the regimental system. So I want people to be proud to be a rifleman, to be a sapper, to be a gunner. I want people to be proud of that. And I want them to be fiercely competitive in military competitions, in sports competitions, in anything that means that I can show I'm better than you. But that can't be at the expense of hurting the bigger machine and the bigger system. We're there to look after each other. And I regularly talk about the three things that I expect in a soldier, which is mental resilience, physical resilience, and then that competitiveness. And I don't care if I'm sat in front of a PTI on a gym mat, I'm going to do my best to beat them when it comes to doing press-ups. Having that love creates that desire to want to fight. We often hear the phrase, I'm fighting to the person to the left and right of me. But as we see in Ukraine, those people to the left and right of you keep changing every single day. So we should prize the regimental system, but we've got to be careful that it doesn't do us damage.
Was it last year that you went on the Marathon des Sables?
Yeah, I was really fortunate enough to be invited by the ABF to make up a team of very different people. We had a great opportunity to raise money for the charity.
And so for those of us who've not done it, can you explain what it is?
It's a multi-stage running event. You basically spend 6 days running in the Sahara Desert. You cover over 250 kilometres in that 6 days, which roughly works out as about a marathon a day. And the big one is that you have to be self-sufficient. So the only thing that the organisers supply you is a burlap sheet to sleep under at night and water. I'm a 16 stone guy. There's only so much food that I could carry. There was five of us in our team. It was a real honour. I'm a trustee of ABF as well. So I was invited because of my position as the Army Sergeant Major. We had Heather Stanning, double gold medal Olympic rower, but also a major in the Army currently serving at Sandhurst. You had Colonel Mark Nooney, who is an MC winner for his actions in the Middle East. Corporal Natalia Plantanova, who had won a TV series called The Circle. And then lastly, who was our celebrity, who was sort of the head of our team, was Judge Rob Rinder. So we were known as Rinder's Runners. A very, very diverse team that had to come together to get through a really tough experience.
And would you do it again?
I don't think I'd do the Marathon des Sables again, but I would do a multi-stage event again. One thing I missed was my wife, and we do a lot of our physical events and challenges together, and not having her with me was really painful. I missed her a lot, and so I'd do another multi-stage event somewhere else in the world with my wife.
So that was one of the things that you learned, that you want to do more of these multi-stage, outrageously challenging events together. What else did you learn?
In 28 years, it was the first time I had time to think and stop. No phone signals, no access to the outside world, no work laptops. It's the first time I've ever really stopped. A very work-orientated individual. It made me realise that at the end of my role as the Army Sergeant Major, that was going to be me calling time on my military career so I could spend more time with my family, start a new career, something different, and look forward to the future.
Wow. You've come to a very clear conclusion there that when you finish as the big badge, you're not going to consider commissioning?
No. I've always been a soldier. And the funny thing with these command sergeant major roles is that we have to go through the commissioning process. I'm always very clear because people would like to call me out as an officer. Regularly let people know that I'm more than happy to be paid as one, but I don't ever want to be one. That's someone else's career. That's another route for someone else to take. having achieved the senior soldier of the British Army is unbelievable to me. And I don't think anything could match that. This isn't about Paul Kearney. This is about future iterations of soldiers that want to become officers. I still don't think our system has moved on enough yet to recognise talent, to truly recognise it. And we cuff ourselves to a policy for what can be perceived as the greater good. Our soldiers, our warrant officers, and our late entry officers are phenomenal people. I met a Scots Guardsman recently who got kicked out of school at 15. It was a classic soldier story of turning up at the gate with a white plastic bag with all of his belongings. As a sergeant, he got a degree. As a colour sergeant, he got his master's. And he's 2 years into a PhD as a company sergeant major. But if he goes on to commission, he will still be judged on the contract he signed with that white plastic bag when he joined the army. And so I think we need to be a bit more agile. We don't need to break the system, but we have generals that can make good choices and can take risk on individuals without setting a precedence. And I don't think we're there yet.
You talked about having the time to reflect about what you were going to do next. When I left the army, I had a break. I was really tired. I didn't know I was tired, but I discovered I was really tired. And having a break was the best thing I could have done, because it ended up with me doing what it was I didn't know I wanted to do, this job that I'm doing. Are you going to take a break in order to refine what it is you think you want to do?
So I've started working since I was 10 years old, and I used to hump gas bottles around. My nan worked in a pub, and she would regularly find people that needed a young set of arms and a back that could move these things around. Then there was a classic paper round working for the electrician. And even when I first joined the army, if I wasn't going on a holiday, then I was working on my leave for some other job. I'm not driven by money, so it certainly wasn't a money thing. It was just that's the way I've been built. And I think having a sustained period of time would feel very alien to me. Look what trouble it got me in when I had a week off to think for myself. If you give me any more, I'd be dangerous.
You're at the end of your time serving in the army. Are you reflecting back on some of the highlights that you've had? And if you are, what would they be?
I'm terrible at taking pictures, and I'm a live in the moment type person, but there are some on my phone, and as I start to flick through, almost 4 years as the Army Sergeant Major have been phenomenal. I've been around the world. I've represented our country. I got to see the Queen, many of the royal family. I was part of the coronation march. But actually, as I do reflect back, it's some of the stuff as a young soldier that I really enjoyed. I told a story today about the young Paul Kearney that was 2 months from leaving training, and we were on a plane to Macedonia preparing to fight our way into Kosovo. And then at 19, helping to build and support refugee camps, supplying potable water to refugees, and then moving across the border, teaching young villagers and young children not to touch mines and to play with mines, doing mine clearance. It was this unbelievable first tour that, as my mum would tell you, she put me on a train as a boy and I returned a man. And that's what I look back on. I think the army is such a phenomenal organisation, but you need to volunteer. Considering my job is to almost be a professional cynic, I am the go-to yes man. Any opportunity the army would offer me, I would go. I've skied, I've parachuted, I've dived, I've been all over the world. I met my wife whilst in the army, whilst we served together. And then I think about all the adventures that we've been on together, bringing up of my stepdaughter and my son with my previous wife. It's all just this huge jumble of happiness and positivity. And I think that's the way you have to be. I don't tend to look back in a negative cycle, because everything's got me to where I am today.
I love that mindset, that positive mindset that you've got. But presumably there have also been challenges that you've faced in your service and in your life. Have they shaped that positive mindset as well?
I've had plenty. It'd be naive of me to brush away some of the stuff I've been through. It's funny, I think the best way to describe it is when I had my interview with General Carlton Smith to become the Army Sergeant Major, he said to me, "You've probably got more experience through your social life than you have through your professional life." I went through a tough time with access to my son. It wasn't a great divorce. I was left in a lot of debt. And those are all things that really shape you and help you to understand that no one lives a perfect life. And I think that was a real powerful tool. And I know I keep bringing up my wife, but she's so central to me. And she was my pillar. She was the person that has kept me straight, has looked after me through this. Both my predecessors, having supported them, got very close to burning out. And I know I, in turn, got close a couple of times, and lucky enough my wife brought me off from that edge. But I think one of the best experiences, and I still talk, probably my biggest win certainly in this job, was during the cost of living crisis and having gone through that issue with debt. And the phrase I used to say was, I worked like a warrant officer but paid like a sapper. So when the cost of living crisis came, I wrote an article in Soldier magazine to talk about what I'd done, how quickly debt becomes a problem and can impact your lives, and actually reaching out for help is the best thing you can do. Probably about 6 months ago now, I received a letter from a young soldier that said to me, "Thank you so much for writing that article. I was close and contemplated taking my life. Me and my partner were close to splitting up or leave the army." He said, "Now we've got our finances back on track. We went to the places that you advised. I'm living a fruitful career in a happy relationship." And so when I still get the cold chills down my spine now. So it doesn't matter. I've had generals tell me good stuff. I've had groups of people tell me. But that's the one that I think I'll probably remember as I leave.
Gosh, that's so important that people can see that you're a human being and that you're being authentic and not hiding from the same challenges. People are held up as some kind of super person, that they're different from the next, or even the Army Sergeant Major, and they're not. And that presumably gives them the encouragement that they could too be the Army Sergeant Major.
Yeah, I think so. And when I first became a Command Sergeant Major, which was of the 3rd Division, I remember an RSM saying to me, "Do you never stop smiling?" And I said, "Well, Sergeant Majors can smile too." And I said, "But here's the big thing. When you become these senior soldiers, it might be your 5th visit of the week, but it'll probably be your only visit to that unit. So if you don't bring 100% of yourself, then you failed them."
Yeah.
I think that's really important. And actually, that RSM became a Command Sergeant Major and done a lot of good as well.
We've met a number of times as well, but I thought it would be better to triangulate my research by asking other people what they thought of you. One of the strongest themes that came through was this phrase that you were a grounded legend, which I think is a brilliant description. I mean, an accolade for anyone to have. Do you think it's a fair description?
I think I'd take the first bit, probably not the second bit. I think the grounded bit's important. I think in a hierarchical organisation, I think we need to always remember where we come from. Everyone's a cog in the team. And if one isn't working properly or one isn't even there, then we're never going to function as well as we can. Everyone has their own life as well as their military life. I think taking the time to talk to people, taking the time to listen to people, it means my wife doesn't see a lot of me, but I think it's really powerful. And with the example I gave you of the young soldier around their debt, sometimes you can do something that can support the whole army. That was a great win. But other times, those individual things count and tend to be much more powerful.
You talked about how your wife doesn't seem very much of you. And you've talked about your work ethic, which seems to be phenomenal. But do you find time to relax? And if you do, how do you relax?
So it was one of the big things that came because Kit, my wife, is uber supportive and she's an ex-soldier and officer herself. She's very busy. And so we try to squeeze time where we can. And one of the things that we've tried to do now is be part of the 5 a.m. club. We will get up at 5, we'll have a coffee together. We go to CrossFit together at our local gym to allow us to build up a community. That means that we've guaranteed that we've had a couple of hours together. We always say you can't control the rest of the day. And I think that's really important. A friend of mine, an American soldier, but he's based out in Europe, he always talks about this work-life balance. And he said that anyone that tries to convince you it's a balance is a liar. Work will always win out. He'd put a pencil on his finger and move it across and say, this is work. He said, but what that means is on that life bit, you have to put more pressure on it. Mm-hmm. So you need to make every second count. And that's what we try and do. So just being in each other's company is brilliant. Other times, long walks with the dogs out on town, pub lunches, all that sort of stuff that you do. And we always try to protect a decent holiday. It's a phone away holiday, because the world will continue without me, without most of us.
As you leave the army, so the next generation is going to be filling your place, do you think that the army needs to recruit differently than it did when you joined?
Yeah, without a doubt. I think as the army's got smaller, we're not embedded into society in the same way that we used to be, which in itself is almost a paradox when you think that we now allow our soldiers to be out on the streets in their uniforms, to travel in their uniforms and be seen, which certainly wasn't the case when I was a young soldier. But it feels like because we're smaller, because we're as busy as we are out on operations, on exercises, means that we don't necessarily have that same connection and that touch. And social media can only achieve so much. And so we need to show people the goodness of what the army, what the military is, and what it's like to serve. We've lived in an environment now which has been off the dividend of a peaceful period at the back end of the Cold War. Mm. And so the need to serve can sometimes feel alien to society nowadays. They want to see the videos of people parachuting out of planes, abseiling out of helicopters, running around and what's deemed to be having a good time. But we recruit young, so actually we should be hitting the gatekeepers as well. But the gatekeepers care about qualifications, trades, pensions, pay. And so we try to do all that messaging in one go rather than say, hey, let's pull people in. We'll take the young men and women this way to show them the cool stuff, and we'll take mums, dads, guardians this way to show them the social mobility that the military can have. And I think that's the powerful message. And I think once you're in our team, you can see how good life can be.
You've achieved amazing things in your career, and you're leaving at the zenith, at the very peak of everything that you can achieve. You may not be someone who looks back and thinks, what's my legacy? But do you have anything that you think, what is my legacy?
I remember a senior officer once being asked a similar question, and they said, well, the army's a constant moving machine, and if you concentrate on leaving a legacy, then you're probably in the wrong business. But I guess half the army will say beards. and that's probably something that will be stuck next to me for a long time. But I think it's, for me, around the NCO Academy. Mm. So my predecessor got the idea into people's head of the NCO Academy. And I like to think that with the NCO Academy team, I've been able to grow that into something that exists now and something that is in its early steps, but that can continue to grow to help to develop that education that we need in our soldier space. We can't just get by on soldiers being great at stabbing people with bayonets and shooting from great distance. We need them to be able to understand how the worlds are changing, and part of that's education and development. And I think that's what the NCO Academy will get after, and in time will grow and grow. And I'm glad to be at the sort of start of that.
One of the other things that we talked about was culture and getting the best from all of the people. I know that there's been considerable work and effort and endeavour to get after that. What do you think the challenges are now?
It never stops. We always need to be on top of this. I regularly use a phrase, and did when I first got into this job, that the army can be beaten up for how it looks after people and some of our poor behaviours. And we should never apologise for that. But we should acknowledge that we don't recruit angels. We recruit devils and make them better. We live by a good set of values and standards. But that takes time to embed into people, and humans are humans, so they're never going to be perfect. We should never stop trying to improve ourselves in this culture area. We are still a combat-focused army. If you go to other armies, they base it on their brain power. So an engineer will take a whole lot more to develop than an infantry, and so their mindset's different, but we're combat-focused. And so that feels like that's the prize when you're at Sandhurst, is to become a combat officer. And then it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We still have big issues between the regulars and the reserves. That's just us not understanding each other. Any regular spends a little bit of time with the reserves. They start to understand what they give up. We can get caught up in our hierarchical systems, into this unit is attached to that reserve unit, is attached to so on. Just reach over the fence and say, hey, you want to come and have a talk? And we could start to build those bonds there. And then the last one is the soldier-officer piece and the bias between that. There still feels like there's a class system. And I'll give you a great example. I saw the poster that you have up to help people understand the rank structures across the three services. And we still have soldiers' ranks with the officers' ranks on top. I would suggest that they need to be side by side. Not that a warrant officer is equivalent of a general, but to acknowledge that they're two completely different career paths. So I can be a professional soldier. It doesn't make me any less than a professional officer. And so I think we need a bit more work there to break that down.
Wow, what a remarkable man Paul is. He is definitely a grounded legend. I hope you laughed and smiled as much as I did during our conversation. His energy, attitude, and mindset are enormously infectious. I learned so much from Paul, and it's no wonder he's made such a massive impact on all those who've met him. He was clear about the importance to remember we are all on one team, that we all need each other, and that we should never stop trying to be our best when it comes to workplace culture. I was struck by Paul's deeply reflective analysis about the challenge of whether to commission, the need to be grounded, and taking time to talk to people. What did you learn from him? We'd love to hear your thoughts at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Thanks for listening. Take care until next time.